podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, I'm John Gibbons and this is an Anfield Wrap special. This is the first part of a 3-hour recording we made with Damien Cavanagh, Richie Greaves and Peter Carney after the collapse of the final trial surrounding Hillsborough. For too many years, too many people impacted by Hillsborough have had to be silent to allow the process to follow. Damien, Richie and Peter, like many others, are survivors of the 15th of April 1989, and they reflect on that day and the 32 years since. These three podcasts are about that, but in the first, from the very start, there is a frank and open discussion around suicide. If you are feeling in any way vulnerable or fragile, please consider whether or not you should choose this moment to listen to this podcast. Should you have any need after listening to the podcast, maybe signpost you to the following. You can call the Samaritans at 116 123 or visit their website at samaritans.org. You can text SHOUT to 85258 or email jo@samaritans.org. Or CALM, which is the Campaign Against Living Miserably, you can call on 0800 585 858 from 5pm to midnight every day. You can also visit their web chat page at www.thecalmzone.net/help/webchat. The NHS also have a range of mental health support, advice and guidance online if you go to www.nhs.uk/mental-health. On the day I spoke to Damien, Peter and Richie, they'd all been to a funeral, and that's where we start.
Thanks for having us in. It is important, the work that you're doing, and I'm mindful how, you know, that we haven't been able to speak for so long publicly and how much interest there is out there. I think the story of the survivors, along with the story of the rescue, the impromptu rescue by the Liverpool supporters on the pitch on that day, are the two biggest untold stories from the greatly told story of Hillsborough. And in my opinion, we've won the battle for the truth, but the lack of justice and accountability still hurts. Personally, I'm in a good place in the fact that I feel empowered by what we've achieved. I think we deserve to feel like we did after the inquests. And I think that I'm going to try and help my comrades and my friends and my brothers and sisters around me to go forward with that. I'm very optimistic about what we've got lined up for that education, etc. It's an important thing in life and a fitting legacy and other legal stuff that's going on. But yeah, before I start properly and before I start talking, we've come from a funeral today from one of our comrades who was a gentleman held in extremely high regard, whose accounts, written and audio, you know, of what had happened to him, horrific, and it showed you how brave he was. He's no longer with us anymore. We've come from that funeral today, and I think it'd be only fitting to dedicate this show to the memory of Rob and, you know, in support of his family, who very generously allowed us to go over to that today. And we had a conversation before we came into the studio today about whether we should mention it or not. We all agreed we should. And I'd just like to pass over to the eloquent Peter Carney now because of why we feel it's important.
Well, I feel it's important because Rob was such a significant figure in the experience of Hillsborough for survivors. Rob went through a terrible experience in the pens and struggled with his experience for years afterwards. But once the Hillsborough Justice Campaign got up and running and the resistance of survivors started building, Rob was a key character in that, and to the point where when the panel report was being done and that, Rob was fundamental in working out how you could bring survivors into them, into that independent inquiry or the independent report, and then for the inquest and the following, the procedures to follow the independent panel. But I think, you know, it's terrible to say, but the significant thing that you have to recognise with Rob is that he took his own life. And that is the ultimate sacrifice that anybody should have to make from any experience that you're tormented to such a point where you feel you have no value on this earth is a terrible, terrible thought. And for me, I can't help but feel that I've been swerving the shadow of Hillsborough, or rather swerving the shadow of suicide, because of Hillsborough since the day it happened. And it just, you know, it does literally come over me at times that I have no place on this earth and I have no value on this earth and I shouldn't be here. Well, you know, it's nonsense, isn't it? First of all, your own life is not yours to take and anybody else's life is not yours to take, which just goes to show that, you know, well, if it's not yours to take, then who has taken Rob's life? And I'm in no doubt that it's the authorities and the people who've protected those who are responsible for Hillsborough that have taken the life of Rob. And even while his heart was beating and his head was ticking over, you know, they were taken away from his life and everything that he'd done to help people understand what the experience of Hillsborough was and how they could manage it and help to set the record straight over it was taken away from time and energy that he could have spent doing other things, you know, particularly for his two girls, you know. So that's, you know, that's the setting, if you like, for this discussion that we're having, that, you know, and it's not the first, you know, I go back to a lad who drives me daily, in a survivors group meeting in the summer of 1989, and this lad gave a rant out to the survivors group we were in, which was very much a therapy-based setting. And this lad ranted and raved about how the trade unions should all be out on strike and the Labour Party should be, you know, bringing motions in Parliament and everything like that, in order to, you know, bring those who were responsible for killing what was then 95 people at Hillsborough to account for what they'd done. And my response to him was, who's going to organise that, lad? Who's going to sort that out? Well, there was a programme on Yorkshire Television that winter, in the autumn that year, called First Tuesday, and they prided themselves on bringing a balanced view on Hillsborough, and that was to say, you know, that there was the police on one side and their supporters on the other side, and pretty soon afterwards, this lad was found hanged in his garden shed. And when I come to remake the Hillsborough Memorial Banner 20 years after the disaster, the banner that I made the week of the disaster, I wanted to put this lad's name on it to tell part of the tale of the untold suffering, and the family were divided as to whether that was appropriate. Some thought it was, some thought it wasn't, so his name didn't go on there. And as soon as Rob dies, I said his name needs to go on the banner, and good enough, the family have agreed that Rob's name will be on the banner as somebody who was killed by Hillsborough. It took them 32 years to kill him, though, didn't it? So, you know, all power to his elbow for all that he'd done in the years in between. But there's that sorrow and that sadness about, you know, the life that he's missed out, the goodness of life that he's missed out on, that he's had to spend time on over Hillsborough.
And it is what it takes out you, Richie, and what it must have took out of all of you and so many others. You know, this is, you know, a very extreme example we're very unfortunately talking about today, but for everyone who was there, for everyone who was connected, you know, with Hillsborough in 1989, you know, there's times when it must have been all consuming. There's times where it's used the word hanging over you there, and that constant presence, whether it's looming large or looming sort of, you know, in the slight distance, is it, presumably it's just it is an ever present.
It's always there for all of us who were there that day, and especially those of us that were in the cages behind the goal. And the reason over the years people have said, you know, why are you still banging on about Hillsborough? You know, why don't you let it lie? Why don't you move on? And the reason is because of the likes of Rob today, you know, obviously 96 died that day. Lots more have been unable to cope with what went on since and have ended their lives. And, there's a lot of people who are still so traumatized by Hillsborough that they can't speak about it even to this day. So what we've always said is those of us that can speak, we've got to speak up for those that can't. And
You know, we'll keep telling the truth for the likes of Rob and for the people that are still alive but can't speak, the people that are traumatised, and we'll speak up for the families of the likes of Rob, and we'll keep telling the truth.
See, someone said last week, I think it was Cathy Long, said, you know, people think that Hillsborough happened 32 years ago. Hillsborough has been happening for 32 years. It comes at you in different ways, and, you know, in what have you, you know, it's not something, it obviously started 32 years ago. The main, you know, the centre of it all, you know, the incidents on the 15th of April 1989. But for us as survivors, it's a living experience. You know, we're not just trying to set the record straight about what happened on the April the 15th, 1989, or, you know, the cover-up that happens following Hillsborough, the inquiries and what have you. We're trying to explain to you what such a traumatic experience, what effect the traumatic experience as on you, it runs through you. And someone at the funeral said today, you know, that all these inquiries and what have you may be over now. And Rob took his life on the Sunday before the Snides who'd done the statements were released from the court on the Tuesday for you know, whatever legal reason. You know, and that to me was significant because What was said in the church today was that, you know, maybe now people can, you know, move forward with their life and try and live it to their best way possible. Well, we want to do that, but they'd always got these nagging doubts and these things that come into play that hold you back. And they emanate from the living experience of Hillsborough, not just the trauma of, you know, being in the pens again and you know, having the flashbacks and stuff like that, but all the things that go on, the survivors who went to football matches and are having digs thrown at them about, you know, being the same old scousers and things like that, who kill their own and stuff like that. All kinds of things, little bits like that, that get to you and put you on your back foot or leave you sitting in the corner for a week because you think, oh, you know, what chance have I got? You know, people really think that I killed my own. You know, stuff like that. It's a living experience, you know. And what we're trying to do is help people deal with that living experience, make sense of it, and move forward in a positive manner with it.
The sad thing as well is it's become a living experience for our families, generation after generation. You know, my youngest daughter's 15 now, and you know, she's like an expert on Hillsborough, and she never asked for that. You know, I just went to, because her dad went to a game of football 32 years ago. She's an expert on Hillsborough. She's doing speeches about Hillsborough in school in front of her class while other girls are talking about makeup and, I don't know, you know, the little pony they might have in a field or whatever. And my little girl got up and had to do a speech because she wanted to defend her dad in front of the whole school with a big picture behind her of the front page of the Scum that day, you know, the truth. She wanted to defend me. So it's not just us that it's affected. It's affected generation after generation.
Yeah, and the families who were waiting for you to come home that day, your ma and dad, the partners you had at the time, the partners you've got since, they know that you're going to be kettled by this. They'll be worried about the impact of any news. They'll be worried about the impact on you, how you're coping. The driving force behind, you know, and what makes, it's difficult, isn't it, really? I thought about this, you know, so you're talking about your daughter, Richard. I speak about me, I speak about my lad, for example. He's learning about Hillsborough School, so we're on side. We're fortunate, living where we live, to be in the bosom of people who do know the school. Right, so that's a good start, isn't it? But there'll be people other parts of the country who haven't got that support. So there's the first thing. Yeah. So we've got that. And that, I think that saved me, to be honest with you. I'm so proud of our history and where we're from in every way, shape or form that, you know, I'm delighted about it. And so that meant I was able to have that pride and that solace and that comfort and that strength, knowing my people and knowing, you know, that what was right and wrong and knowing that that was the score, but that wasn't there for everybody. And one of the things that you're talking about affecting generations, I always dial it like in the way that there was a time when it seemed as though the campaign for justice was going nowhere. It seemed like we'd lose, if you like. We'd sort of get timed out, because that's what the Brits do, don't they? They time you out. Yeah. And then I always had it in my mind about, like, you know, the boys who were shot for cowardice in the First World War, they were murdered by the state. Everyone looks back and now and says, yeah, that was murder, that was horrific, that, but they lost their lives. They were made an example of, and their families were shamed. So there's a parallel to that. And I thought this would all happen. The truth would be more delivered historically by what we'd written and by what we'd said, but we kind of leapfrogged that with the legal process and the support that we gave each other. But what really burnt in me, and becoming a parent changes your life in a way that you can't describe until you're there. And, you know, that's the way I've felt about it. I was thinking it in terms of, so if we get timed out and I'm no longer around and my lad's got a question about this, you think, what was all that fuss about? I want to know about it. And his research then ends up in lies. I'd come out the grave. What if I had great grandkids who read The Scum because we lost? Because we got timed out? And I had this thing in my head where my dad went to the FA Cup final in 1965. I go in 89 and I take James to Old Trafford in 2006. There's three generations, same last name, same blood. If Hillsborough had happened to my dad's generation, there was no footage, there wasn't enough footage around to back up the fact that the Busies was lying. In 2006, the cameras were all over the place with the TV that they wouldn't have even tried to get away from me. But I was just in a timeline in the generations of my family, happened to be on the one in the middle, where they almost got away with it. And as things move on, the strength of our community, and not just our community, people around, you know, around the country, around the world who support us, who then become our community, I'm proud to say, they've given us the strength to get this over the line. And you might think to yourself, well, go and have a nice life. You don't have to get so involved. And I understand that. So anyone who hasn't been involved shouldn't feel guilty about that. They've escaped that day. They've walked away from the carnage. They've been able to raise their families. They've been able to pursue their interests. They've been able to achieve their potential. I'm glad that they did. I wasn't able to do that. And I've just got this thing, and I know that we're sitting on this table now. I could close my eyes at any moment and go right back to having just escaped. I can smell what it was like in the pens, and I mean smelling death. So who's going to time you out for that? What sort of man are you? What sort of person will say, well, okay, then, look, it's gone on long enough. Go on, then. How can I remember, you know, me mates who went through all that? How can, you know, at a time from 1989, we had no power in the media. You know, John, you're doing us a great service here in the fact that, in the way that you're doing, the way the technology is, in the fact that social media gets it out there, and no one's more, you know, accessible to the Liverpool fans than you at the Anfield Rap, you know, what all the work that you do. And it's very important to me that in the fact that it gets it out there. We didn't have this voice in 1989. We didn't have this voice in 1990, 91, 92. Keep going forward. At a time when I had post-traumatic stress disorder to a moderately severe extent. At a time when I got a ticket for someone who didn't come home. At a time when I went to school with someone who was on the barrier that collapses in Pentry. And mates with other people who went to that game. You know, a friend of ours goes to match with us. His brain damaged from being starved of oxygen. Head three. How the fucking hell am I going to drop this? I can't drop it. It's me. I can't get out of it. These are me emotions. And so I've probably got the straight-lacedness of me mum about the correctness and the devilment and talkativity of me dad put together has made me just have to do this. And I'm glad I have. But... And so in Richie's daughter getting up to defend the truth is so important and so empowering. And he was dead proud when he was telling us about it. And I was made up, when we were talking about it. We should never have had to do this. And so now we have the opportunity to do it. I feel a duty that's beyond the grave for most people to look back at us in years. And, you know, if things that go wrong aren't admitted to, how do you learn lessons? And if a community of people and a generation of people are ripped off, well, I'll tell you what, rip everyone else off, because you're not ripping us off. You know, all our grandparents and all our families and whatever have you, we don't deserve any of this. And I just couldn't drop it. And I'm so glad about that, and I'm glad about the empowerment of education going forward in a constructive manner. I don't want to just shout at everyone who was a police officer. There were people in uniform on the day who did a job, sadly, hardly anywhere near enough. There's been a conspiracy against us for such a long time. They've timed us out, and so there's not enough jigsaw pieces left on the table for them to put a justice or accountability together. But we are the truth, and we've never changed in what we've got to say. And the world can know it. I don't want the world to know the story of the Hillsborough disaster. I don't. I want them to have a nice life. But if they do find out about the Hillsborough disaster, I want them to know what happened and not what didn't. Because people's lives were changed forever and others didn't come home. And that driving force has been an achievement which is beyond stunning, quite frankly. And I'm proud to be part of it.
Do you know what? In many ways, the less you know, the better. Because the deeper you delve into Hillsborough, the dirtier it gets. The more you know.
Yeah.
And when you go into the length, when you start looking at police statements and so-called independent statements, and you're seeing statements that have been put forward by relatives of senior police officers to have a go at us. And you're seeing all these bent statements that were put forward to every inquiry that's gone on over the last 32 years. I've lost my train of thought there.
You're quoting every dark example of what the state did to us.
Yeah.
And we were supposed to just take it and go along with it. In the first place, for a lot of people, it was a case of, you know, you'd have to get on with life. You know, all right, you've had this bad traumatic experience, you know, but you have to get on with life, you know, you've got to get back to normal and things like that. It was never like that for me. It didn't fit that narrative for me anyway, because in my personal life, I'd just had a week on a barge with a group of kids from Kirkdale. We went from Birmingham on a really bright sunny day, April 1st, 1989. And come back on April the 8th. Well, April Fool's Day was right, because the sun was blazing down and the kids were on the top of the barge getting their sunburns and what have you. And then we went out into the countryside, and from the Sunday to the Thursday, we had 6 inches of snow and we had hailstone and we were stuck on the barge. And it wasn't a very pleasant experience. What should have been a good week away with the kids? It wasn't a very pleasant experience. The weather broke on the Thursday and on the Friday we got back into Birmingham. I was just so glad to be back in Birmingham. I mean, who's ever glad to be in Birmingham unless you're at Villa Park for the semi-final? we were glad to be back into Birmingham. We went to watch Rain Man in the local cinema and I fell asleep halfway through. Anyway, the following week I was full of flu, and I went to Sheffield on the last of the flu. I couldn't be arsed. I remember sitting in the car. I was glad I wasn't driving. And I remember sitting in the car on the way there and just folding into the corner, you know, cause I didn't have no energy. I didn't have no go in me. You know what I mean? Well, when we come back and, you know, I mean, I was glad to be on this earth, you know, where there really was, but then, you know, I was doubting myself about whether I wanted to do the job that I was in and stuff like that. Well, I was in such a state physically anyway that, you know, I had a few weeks off on the sick and that. So the idea of going back to a normal life wasn't like the world was never going to be the same. You know, I knew that. And our son was due to be born. I'd found out on the Thursday while we were away that you know, Tina was going to have a baby and... you know, I was glad about that. And I used to say, you know, H is for Hillsborough, H shall and hell. H is for half time and happy as well. And I had this mantra going on in my head that I kept on for a long time. And it was like a driving force for me to, you know, well, when the baby's born, I'll get going again. You know what I mean? And then things will change. But the baby was born, but things didn't change. You know what I mean? I was still suffering this mental trauma of being independent. You know, and it was all flashbacks and stuff like that. But, you know, I didn't know what the point of being on this earth was, you know what I mean? I didn't feel any value, didn't think I was of any use or had any purpose to be on this earth. So I was struggling with my own being, you know what I mean? Mm. And I was being told I was a lucky one. I used to say, well, lucky you're six on the dice, mate.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it just didn't wash, but, you know, that's the way we were. And when the first inquest, it was the family's responsibility, you know, so there was, for a couple of years, there was nothing, there was nothing people could do, or there was nothing expected of people that were in the pens other than to get on with their own life. It was for the families to deal with, you know what I mean? Mm. And we were sort of like, it wasn't that we were pushed to one side, we were just expected to get on with life, you know what I mean? But people were struggling with that, really, really struggling. I mean, I've just mentioned a lad there, you know, who didn't see the end of that year, you know what I mean? And you think, you know, Jesus, swept out, how do you keep going? But you're always trying to, you know, to get on with life, to make the most of life, you know, and that's what I've done from the word go. I've always been chasing that thing. I've got to try and do better. I've got to try and be better. I've got to try and, you know, get on with it. Like, you know, but for all that I did, that I, you know, I just didn't have the wherewithal or the, you know, I don't know what it was, but I just didn't have the mojo, and I had everything to live for.
Mm.
You know what I mean? But you know, it was like, you know, it was like a weight I was carrying around, and it was slowing me down and holding me up and what have you, like, you know.
I think what we've always had as well, I always think, you know, when you've gone on holiday and people have heard your accent ever since then, and I always feel as if you've got to kind of prove yourself. I always think as soon as they listen to you, they think, I think they think the worst of you, because of the lies that were told and because of the stereotypes that were built up about you. And I think for years, ever since, I think we've been kind of having to prove ourselves, countless times. We've been having to justify ourselves. We've been defending our city, our people, everyone that was there. Like, it just goes on and on and on. It's relentless, isn't it? The way you keep having to defend yourself.
Yeah, no, that to me that's a symbol of the that's a sign of the opposing forces that were clashing, the force of those who had the human experience of going to a football match and seeing 95 people killed in their company, and then the community and the families around them, and the force of those that were responsible for it were basically agents of the state, and all the community and what have you, the families and what have you around them, like you said there, you know, they were literally encouraging family members to make completely false statements about what they'd seen on the day and what had gone on the day, in order to protect those that were responsible for the disaster happening. You know, I mean, you know, that's what that is part of to me. So people take on board newspaper reports and what have you as being, you know, what actually happened and stuff like that. Well, it wasn't like that in Liverpool. Liverpool, you know, we knew straight away. We knew from people who we knew what had gone on. You know, not just, not me, but people around us, you know. And, you know, when I go back, you know, I kept the papers at the time. I wasn't capable of reading the paper in the first few weeks. I couldn't wait to see the end of the football season. My mate sobbed his heart out when Arsenal beat Liverpool. And I said, listen, lad, I said, there's some things in life you can do nothing about.
No,
last minute winners is one of them. I wasn't asked. I was glad to see the back of the football season.
And it still annoys me now that, I mean, it's the greatest moment in Arsenal's history, isn't it? It's there Istanbul or there Rome or whatever. And you can't take that away.
You can't be close to them, can you?
It leaves a sour taste in your mouth.
But what I was, you know, what you were bringing up to me then was, you know, you find where you are in your own life, you know, and that's what kept me going, is the people around me. Whatever I thought of myself and what my value was and my worth, it was them that around me. I had a conversation when I heard about Rob dying. I immediately phoned a significant player in the Hillsborough thing, because the last time I'd seen Rob was in his company, Phil Skreighton. And I was still on the phone to him 20 minutes later when my sister got off the train, that I was picking her up at Lime Street Station to take her up to my mum's. And When she come to the train, she showed her head to the side window. She was trying to tell me to open the boot, signalling me to open the boot to put a thing in. She had a dirty big grin on. And when I turned my head to look at her face dropped. You know, because she realised I was in the state.
Yeah.
I was bubbling, you know, I was blubbering and crying and what have you. And anyway, I had the conversation. She sat there listening to the end of it. And we got going. I said, oh, sorry about that. She said, oh, no, it's all right. She's brilliant. Like, you know what I mean? She's been a nurse 35 years. And anyway, when we get going in the car, you know, that tells you what's going on and that, like, you know. And she said, oh, she said, I didn't hear that. She said, you know what? She said, I've never seen you like this before. I said, Mary, I said, you don't blurt these things out at a family gathering. I said, but this has been going on for 32 years now. And it has, you know. Yeah. And I've had these regular breakdowns, these regular, you know, pandemic. I've had about 5 meltdowns since the pandemic started, just because, you know, I can't cope with the situation, you know what I mean? It exposes your frailties and your vulnerabilities and that, like, you know what I mean? And I have no doubt about it that it comes from Middlesbrough, you know, that sensitivity, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the point, you know, what I was getting at here is that, you know, what them other people are listening to and taking on board are the mechanisms in which those that are in control and those that have power and stuff like that use in order to keep their control and their power and their status in the world. And we're just collateral damage, the likes of us. You know what I mean? They're quite willing and go out of their way in order to maintain the positions and the powers that they have. And if you happen to suffer from that, or you know, your life is less worth living because of that, then so be it, because they're not going to give anything up. You know what I mean? That's the way it works.
Yeah.
I always found, like, from the start of it, it was like, well, you've survived first, so there's your luck. And then the dynamic pours into your house, doesn't it?
Mm.
And so it goes home. And obviously my mum and, you know, my ma's frantic, my dad. And it's only only since I became a dad myself that I could in any way imagine what that was like for them. And they just want to see you get better, and they just want to see you do well. I didn't want Liverpool to play on that season.
No, me neither.
No.
I know Aldridge felt the same, and it was made up when he said it. I went, that's it. We don't want to play on. Doesn't matter about the league. Doesn't matter about the cup. Doesn't matter at all. But don't get me wrong. I also respect and understand play on. I get it. So that's sound. I'm like, okay. Then it's about getting on with your life, isn't it? And then it's sort of like, well, here's the summer. And I remember the night before the opening game for the following season, and I'd renewed my season ticket. And I was like, well, okay, it's, you know, you've had a horrific summer. You've cried every time you've gone out on the ale. You've hardly been in work. I worked in the Royal Insurance at the time. Two of their employees were unlawfully killed. I was nearly. Another one. I was fortunate that I was working in a place right in the middle of town with thousands of employees, which subsequently got the freedom of the city of Liverpool. I was surrounded by compassion. But I also understand that I was surrounded by people who could never understand, and it would be unfair of me to think that they should be able to understand. And at some point, they'll have a mental cut-off point saying, well, okay, maybe the start of next season's for you. Maybe the end of 89, maybe the next year's for you. Maybe it'll take a year or two for it to come out of you. And it just didn't, and it couldn't stop. And if I hadn't been there, I'm sure I'd have said those same things. I went on holiday in 1990 with 3 close friends who I played football with. In the way that you do. It wasn't the maddest holiday in the world. It was just a good 4 lads going away who played football together, young men. I struggled during that holiday. I was struggling at the time. I'm glad I went. I had a good time. I spoke to my mate, one of those lads, a little while ago. He just said, Cav, we didn't cut you any slack. We didn't didn't understand. And I just said, well, if it had been you instead of me, I wouldn't have done. What do you know when you're 20? What do you know if you hadn't been there? So no one should feel guilty. Going forward into the 1990s, when, you know, we have all our conversations and, you know, Taylor happens and the challenges are happening. It's sort of like, I knew I was getting, you know, I knew people around me would be, you know, people as close to me as who are now, and there's no hard feelings on this at all, but I know behind me, you know, they're being, listen, lads, you've had a hard time. you're going on about it too much and you aren't doing yourselves any good. Mm. And getting together is taking you backwards. And it wasn't until the panel that it blew the lid off for some people. And I had people who were like, you could see, it was like, Jesus, I knew it was bad. But I didn't know it was that. I didn't really understand what you were fighting about until the conspiracy was revealed. That's the point. So, to my understanding, I went on the Saturday night, I came home and I was, you know, I felt feared the worst for certain people, and unfortunately it was proved right. And then a mate of mine, a tough boy, our hardest boy, got on great with me dad, and he was waiting for me. And my mum said, he wasn't a bit of good, you know, Terry. But he come back, said, I'm taking him out for a drink tonight. I'll take him out for a drink, you know. And he come back and he took me out, and I can't remember going home, and I remember crying myself to sleep. But I remember in the consciousness of the story, it was what we reported wasn't. I know that we were lied about with the gate and all that capable, but the media was coming behind it. It was sort of like, you know, it was quite clear what the score was. And on the Sunday night, I found out about somebody else. I didn't know. I was out for a bevy with the lads, and it was sort of like everyone sort of wanting to be with each other and wanting to support each other. And a couple of lads who didn't always go out, they came out too. Reds and Blues, it was like, oh no, we're all going out together tonight. You know, and then one of them, like, he said, you know, someone had died and I broke down again. And you know, he's like, I'm sorry, I've upset you. I was like, well, I needed to know. And it was just terrific, you know. And then they had the papers out, the Sunday papers out, and there was one of my mates, you know, in the pictures, you know, getting pulled up into the stand above and that. And then, you know, the stories out there, the meeting, everyone's horrified and that. And there's only one subject on the news at all, never mind the first subject. And then the scrum on the Wednesday.
That come right out there.
So I was off work at this point. I got, what happened, on the Monday I went to work and people were made up that had come in because I had people coming up to different floors in where we were working in town, you know. No one wanted to ask. One lad come up from the floor and said, it was me who got nominated to come up to see you with your chair. And I was consoling people in the toilets, two young boys, one of them younger than me, one of them my age, slightly younger as well. Broken anyway. And I was comforting them, you know, as if I'm, you know, when I was 20, I must have looked up at fucking 12. And I didn't know anything about anything. And then that comes. And I remember going out for a pint with my mum and dad, which I never did, generational. I wish my lad had wanted to take me out for a pint, to tell you. But it was in that generation, my dad was like, didn't want to be me mate. And he had that old school thing about him where I will prove my love by the hours that I work, by the, you know, with the first in our family, with our own front, you know, the only own house with their own front door. This is what we're going, you know, this is, you know. And, you know, and then they got my mum on the other side, you know, emotional, and that's the family dynamics. My half of it couldn't work this out. He said, you shouldn't have told your mum what happened. He had that old school about him, you know, as if ladies shouldn't know this. And he struggled in the years in the fact that I couldn't get myself together. That I had to man up. I'm not blaming my dad. He was a product of his time. I've got great strength from my dad. Talk about him all the time. Made up a look and sound like him. I've got no hard feelings on that. But it added to the pressure that we were under. And we deferred to the families, quite right too. They've always been more important than us. They lost people. I came home. My mum didn't lose anybody. My mum said to me, and my dad said it too, and I can count on the fingers, on half the fingers of one hand, how many times my dad said he loved me. But I know that he did, and he showed me in every way, other than the word. If we'd have known what you were going to go through, we would never have brought you into this world. That was a fucking heartbreaking fucking thing to be saying. That's the depths of which we were put through. And the agents of this state trampled all over that. Collateral damage. You are correct, Peter.
I don't think people realised what we've been through until the HIP report come out, as you said.
And that's people within the city as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but even people that understood. People that totally understood Hillsborough. And then after it, I remember going to a game. I don't know, it must have been must have been Everton or United or something like that, you know, where you're on the aisle all day. And
look at now, you cutting down.
Fucking games you want to hang all
day to me. But we ended up in town late at night, and everyone had drifted away, and it was just me and another lad, and I can't even remember who it was. And I must have been upset because there was an anniversary coming up, and he said, none of the lads ever mention it. And I said, no one fucking cares, and this, that, and the other. And he said, they do. He said, fuck it, they don't mention it in front of you because you were in them cages.
They don't want to.
But it's like when someone dies, isn't it? It's like when someone dies close to you and you think, yeah, I don't mention it, just talk about anything else. Mm. But it's better to talk to the people, I think, to show that you care rather than, because the person's thinking, well, no one cares about what's going on in my head. And that's the way it was with Hillsborough. And then after the HIP, I think a lot of people then said, fuck, you know, Christ, I can see why you were such a lunatic with the dump by the scum stickers, and you wouldn't let it drop, and you got yourself into so much shit. And people were saying, fucking, I'll have a day off. And we could never have a day off, could we?
No, we never will have a day off. That's the point, is that, you know, it's a constantly moving thing. It's life. Life doesn't stand still. It doesn't stop. I always remember something my mum said when my dad died. I was only 17 at the time, but when she come home, she said she come out of the hospital. And she stood at the hospital door. She said, the doors opens in front of her, you know, them sliding doors. And the doors opens in front of her. And she looked out over to the road. And she seen the traffic lights changing from red to green. And they go red, yellow, and then green, don't they? She said, and I watched them change. She said, and then I watched them change again. So she stood there for a minute or so, wasn't she, watching this go on. And she realised, you know, that life goes on, and I've held on to that since then. You know, that's 12 years before Hillsborough, you know, and that's true, and that adds to the perspective that I have about, you know, life is a rhythm, life is about movement, is about, you know, a rhythm, about movement, about dynamic, you know what I mean? And the big energy in that dynamic is your social being, because always at any one time, you know, we're getting into philosophy here, aren't we?
We always do, Peter.
Well, you do, because you question your own existence, and the struggle that I have, the mental struggles that I have, boil down to existential anxiety. I'm anxious about my own being, you know, and that's what rocks me or rattles me or makes me angry or bitter or frustrated. It's rooted in my own existence, the fact that I am here. You know, and that's the closest I've ever come to not being here. What I'm saying is that, is that it's a rhythm, it's a movement, it's a dynamic. That's what life is. And the social part of your being, you're always two things at once. You yourself individually, and you've got to wrestle with them things about whether or not you have any value on this earth, or what value you have on this earth and what have you. And that at the same time runs alongside your social being and very much informs it. I think you're very sharp to this, Richie, about, you know, your connection with other people, and how, you know, you see yourself in a group, and how you see other groups see you, how we're, you know, for shorthand we decide that all Geordies are all, you know, I don't know what all Geordies are, but, you know, Scousers are, you know, we used to rob up caps and stuff like that, you know what I mean? And then we, you know, all Scousers kill their own and all that, you know. It's an integral part of who you're being. It's a big part of who you're being. And that, you know, that has an impact on how you feel individually for yourself and who you are, you know, it's a big, big thing. And for me, I held on to that a lot, you know, because I struggled with myself, you know, with my own being. So I tried to hold on, and always, honestly, from the minute I went down the ground, I come out to the ground. We didn't even go in the grounds. We only got to the gates. The gates weren't even open on the Sunday. And I come away from the gates And I went to my mate and said to him, listen, we're going to have to make a banner. Well, you know, thinking about it now, that's me saying, you know, we need to move forward. We need to do something positive here. And, you know, and that's what I've always tried to do from the word go. It doesn't always work, you know, and sometimes you fuck up bad style, you know, but if you've got good intentions, you know, and what have you, then, you know, at least you can feel better within yourself, whether it works or it doesn't work, you know what I mean? But it's not easy, you know, and, you know, I think that that's what you're struggling with all the time is to get on with life, you know, is to, you know, make the best of the situation you're in, you know.
You're talking about your self-worth and that. I've been dead lucky in the fact that, and I don't know why, and I'm not like some, I'm not an arse or not, am I? You know what I mean? I haven't got any special skills or not. I'm just like going about myself or whatever. I'm not like really strong-willed or anything like that. But I've never had any guilt at all, not one bit. Not a grain of sand on the beach, not one bit. I got me ticket. I went to match and everyone around me didn't do anything wrong. And then I came home and I'm glad I did for me mum and me dad, me community. And subsequently, so I'm sitting in the company of Richie Greaves here, who's gave evidence at the first inquest, gave evidence at the second inquest. And in that time of people around us, right?
I'd be interested to know what Richie's immediate experience.
Let's talk about it. But I want to talk about you as well, Peter, as well, just on this point, on the fact that if we didn't have the likes of Richie, who was going up there, and while those highly paid, skilled lawyers with an agenda, Richie stood there, tall, for us, everything against them, unswerving. And in all that time, done the same thing. And then yourself, Peter, never mind the lovely Tina and Tom, never mind them, and all the other mates that you've got. There are certain people within the campaign where we would not have landed on the moon had it not been for they, and you were one of those.
Yeah.
You do, you know, in the instances
so,
that I was doing.
So you're on this earth, you're on this earth for me.
You always stuck your head above the parapet when no one else did.
I've used the expression, Adrian, who's not with us, unfortunately, Adrian Tempany, who's not up to being with us today, for understandable reasons, and I look forward to seeing him soon. He always said you were ahead of the curve. Because Adrian's better with his words tonight. He's paid for it. But you were always ahead of that. And that was an important part of the survivor. And we're talking about the survivor's journey in the fact that the most important thing will always be the families. Of course it will. Nothing's more important than that. They lost people who did not come home. Now, next is us. One of the profound things that happened to me was somewhere in the equation and in being spoken to was, well, you can give the testimony of the people who was killed because you was next to them. And I was like, yeah, I can, yeah. And I thought, that's a profound thing to be saying because you've got family members.
Speak for themselves.
Yeah, scratching their head saying, well, the video coverage of the day is extensive, but it's nothing like it'd be available now. Certainly, it wouldn't be appropriate and graphic, and I've certainly seen graphic stuff, which was very difficult to deal with. But they were like, please do speak.
Mm.
We want to know what happened.
Well, Richie did speak.
That's exactly what I was going with.
When I first met you, that meeting in the Stanley.
Yeah.
Should I tell her?
Yeah, by all means, yeah. You know.
I got introduced to Damien through a lad called Mike Nicholson.
He'd done a brilliant documentary, didn't he?
Yeah. While the campaign was basically on its arse, he stepped forward and he thought, I'll do a YouTube video.
What year is this, Rich? Roughly.
Oh, 2007?
Maybe before that.
But what he wanted to do was just put it out on YouTube. And
he did a brilliant job, yeah.
And something reminded me before, back in 2002, I didn't think we were going anywhere with this. And you mentioned it, Damien. And so what I done, I just wrote down my account on pieces of A4, like South Yorkshire Police did, instead of putting it in the pocket notebooks all them years before. Mm. I just wrote it down on blank pieces of A4, but it wasn't reviewed or altered in any way. It was a permanent record in case I died, because I thought that was the only way my kids, that was the only way my kids would be able to read the truth. So that's what that was.
You're talking about
our meeting in
the Stanley.
Oh, the Stanley, yeah. So I got introduced through Mike Nicholson, and he said, you know, you're going to love this lad. He's the same type of character as you, and blah, blah, blah. And we hit it off immediately. And well, as soon as I met you, you said, see the lad over there, and he had a brown jacket on, didn't he? A lad by the door. And he said, he can't speak about Hillsborough. And I said, yeah, okay. So, you know, I went with a lad that was the same. And he goes, so maybe 50% of us who were there in them cages can't speak about it because they're that still that traumatised by it. 96 of us that were there died. Many more have committed suicide since. Loads have moved to the other side of the world to get away from it. You know, the number that were in there dwindles and dwindles, doesn't it? Who can speak about it? And he said, we've got to speak out. And I went home to my missus that night and I just broke down and I said, I can't do it. I just can't do it. But the thing was, I seen with Damien was, when I first met him, I looked into his eyes and I said, when I went home to my missus, I said, I can see it in his eyes, like a burning, a sense of injustice and like hurt, and I could see everything in his eyes.
Suffering.
Yeah. And I just said, fucking hell, it's like when you look at him, it hurts you. And he go, and she said, you're the same. You can't see it.
And you don't see it in the mirror.
No, you can't.
You see it in others.
And then,
but you know instantly.
Yeah.
If somebody told you, I remember in the early days, we had this survivors group where I met the lad who I mentioned before, who took his own life. And there was another fella in that group who was from Oldham. And he said he was in the Pens and he just happened to be there. He wasn't particularly a Liverpool supporter, he said, but I just happened to be there going to the match and that, like, you know what I mean? Getting in on the big game and what have you, like. And he said, all right, yeah, sounds, yeah. So anyway, we used to have these meetings, and this week he come into the thing with these pictures that he has. And he'd drawn these pictures to explain the experience of being in the Pens. And one picture was a picture of a copper strangling a liver bird. And the liver bird's head was properly drooped, you know what I mean? And I said to him, is that bird's head? He says, yeah. I said, well, I'm not fucking Zed. And he said, most of the people in the Pens aren't fucking Zed either. He said, so you can't be doing the Zed liver bird, can you? it's not right to be doing the Zed liver bird, you know what I mean? So they fucking haven't killed us. Said the bastards were looking us in the eye but wouldn't respond and help us to save our lives. Said, but they fucking didn't kill us all. You know what I mean? So pulled face at me, like, you know what I mean? So he shows me this other picture. And this other picture is the coppers looking with the backs to the Pens looking away, you know, by the way that they're ignoring our complaints and all that. I said to him, is that the Pens? He said, yeah. I said, is that your view from in the Pens? He said, yeah. I said, is that what you're seeing? He said, yeah. I said, fucking hell. I said, you must have been in a different pen from me. I said, because every copper I seen in front of the Pens was looking right at us.
Yeah.
I said,
yeah.
When we were screaming for me fucking life, I said, the bastards were just ignoring us. I said, yeah. What coppers did you see with the fucking back to the Pens? I said, I think you need to go fucking see someone, you. It turns out he was a fraud.
No question about it. Said, those two things there, that just doesn't sound like anyone, anyone in this room.
Well, them same things, like I'm verbalising it and giving you a big example of it, but it's exactly the same as what
on that Monday morning. Remember? Do you remember the front page of the Mirror? It was a full back and front thing on the Mirror, and I was right in the middle of it. You could see me clearly, and I've always said, like, the view the photographer had that took that was the same one the Busies had.
That was
standing at the front on the edge of the pitch, and the ones that were standing.
Those pictures,
the ones that were standing looking into the Pens, pushing people back in as well.
That's right. You know what I mean?
They had that view.
None of them coppers ever faced any charges.
And if you see that view they had.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's horrific.
And not one of them thought to ask one of their seniors if they could, you know, to mention it to their seniors that something was going on and stuff like that. But I think you said right. You just know instantly that someone, if somebody said to you, I was in the Pens, You wouldn't
if
think
you were
much.
If you abandon your instructions room, yeah.
Well, the least that you'd expect of any human being is to say, "Listen, there's people in distress here."
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But none of them's on that. You tell me, you know the evidence better than I do, Richie. But you tell me where the evidence is that any of them coppers that were stood in front of them pens said to their senior, "Listen, there's people in distress here." Because I don't think it exists, mate. I don't know it in the detail that you know it. But, you know, I don't think it exists and the way they covered the pitch.
There was video evidence as well that came out at the Warrington inquest where the South Yorkshire Metropolitan Ambulance Service, they had two what they call first responders who were sitting up at the cop end, which is the end of the ground opposite the Leppins Lane end. And they must have seen what was going on down the Leppins Lane end. So they walked down the side of the pitch and it was all on video.
I've seen that.
They walk right down the side of the pitch in front of the north stand where the Liverpool supporters were. Then they come right along the Leppins Lane where we were. They go in front of them cages. They look in. They see what's going on. And what did they do? They could have called an emergency, a major incident then. The ambulance service arrived with cutting equipment and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the fences are down.
Yeah.
What did they do? They legged it.
Yeah,
they got off.
Terrified.
Yeah, they got off. Yes. Yeah.
It's incredible, isn't it, when you think back about it? We're talking about looking into the pens. I mean, I've got recollections distinctly of two officers, and I know how close I was to the front. I was a bit shocked about it when I looked at the study of the layout of the pens, and I thought I was further away from the fence at first. And I think that was because I was an experienced match goer. I don't know what a crowd felt like. But then I was in a crowd that was more than twice what it should have been. So I was like counting heads. So it was like, so I thought it was that many heads back, but actually it was half as many heads further. So if I'm making sense of what I'm saying. In that noise, during that screaming, I remember making eye contact with a busy. And I had me, because I'm a little fella, I always had to have my hands up, you know, in the terraces because, you know, imagine me standing behind Richie. I'd ask him what the fucking score was, wouldn't I? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I had this, like, in between, you know, I always had my hands up, and a lot of people around me, and it was a fluke, this. But, like, then arms be down by the sides until you were restricted, but I had my hands up, and that saved me from, I don't know what, serious injury. I don't know. But in that time, I remember shouting to a busy, probably the length of this room, in that noise, open the gates. And I remember him deliberately just looking at me and pointing behind me, like in that carnage with the view you're talking about. And he mouthed at me. I didn't hear him shout, but he mouthed at me, "Get back." And I'm like, "Well, you're on your own here, aren't you, Jamie? Because the fucking people in uniform aren't getting you out." That come across him. So there's one thing about what was looking in. I'm grateful that photograph that you're talking about in the Daily Mirror was taken because it illustrated to people around the world the horror of what we were going through. I would like to think, and it's easy for me to say it. In fact, I'll apologise for saying it now. The fact that I was able to get stuck in with the advertising boards is neither here nor there. I didn't have to do that. And had I been shocked in a position where I was shocked that I couldn't have done that, I'm still not guilty of any. In fact, I'm helping by the fact that I've got out the crush. So sound. That's the way God makes me. And life's a team game. It's all that, isn't it? But I would like to think of the orders that I might have been under, I'd be quite happy to go on disciplinary to fucking save someone's life. Because there's no doubt in my mind of what they could see. Absolutely not. The other experience, what the other officer have got, as I'm crawling over people's heads and as I'm getting to the gate at the front and as I'm relieved that I'm escaping, pushes me back in. And the words are etched on my mind, "You fucking twat." And he pushes me back in. And I'm like, "Well, you don't go against the busies or I'm not going back in there." And I just wriggled and he threw me onto the pitch. The conduct of the officers at the fence hasn't been explored enough, in my opinion.
No.
I could have made a complaint about that officer and chose not to because I thought, how would you react if you were presenting? If you got up in the morning to do Saturday overtime, right, thinking you were banking it so you could, you know, take your missus out or whatever it was, and you were presented with Hell on Earth, and then you acted slightly inappropriately, who's going to blame you for that? I'd be out of order for that. So I chose not to make a complaint about that officer. After the panel report was published, I read that officer's statement, and that fucking twat. So I quote him back, lied for the conspiracy. And I've got evidence that I was supposed to be a witness and supposed to join Richie at those inquests. And I've got it. And I was pulled from being a witness because they didn't want me to talk about the officers at the perimeter fence. What a...
Because they've been under orders, that's the excuse, isn't it?
That was the first hour of this three-part special with Damien, Richie and Peter. Huge thanks to them for their honesty. Please think about the people you may choose to share this with and their well-being. To reiterate, should you have any concerns about your own reaction or well-being, please remember Samaritans.org. You can call at 116 123 or text SHOUT to 85258 or email joe@samaritans.org. Or the Campaign Against Living Miserably, who you can call on 0800 5858 from 5 p.m. to midnight every day, or visit their web chat page, thecalmzone.net/help/webchat. Or for the NHS advice online on mental health, go to www.nhs.uk/mental-health. Thank you. Sports Social Podcast Network.